is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, the FDA has found low levels of a cancer-causing chemical in the popular heartburn drug Zantac. We'll talk about what we know and what to do if you're taking that medication. First, Barbie has some new friends.
Introducing Creatable World, a doll line designed to keep labels out and invite everyone in. Making play more inclusive than ever before.
It's a video clip from Mattel, the creator and longtime reinventor of the Barbie doll. The thing about the new dolls is that they're not styled traditionally female or male. They have a variety of skin tones, hair lengths, and outfit options that, in many cases, blur gender lines. Tanya Lee Stone wrote about the history and culture of Barbie dolls in her book, The Good, the Bad, and the Barbie. She teaches in the professional writing program at Champlain College in Vermont. Her latest book is called Girl Rising. Tanya, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, what do you think of this move by Mattel, this line of what a lot of people are calling gender-inclusive dolls?
I think it's fantastic. I think it's a very important step to take, and when a company the size of Mattel takes one, it really sends a message for inclusivity to the retail world in general.
Now, these are the makers of Barbie doing this, but if I have this right, Tanya, these the Creatable World dolls are not part of the Barbie-verse, if we can call it that. They're not a part of the Barbie line. Do I have that right?
That's an interesting distinction. I didn't come across that when I looked into it a little bit further. But if you mean that they're not being called Barbie dolls,
right.
Is that what you mean?
Well, yeah,
yeah,
and they're not
true.
The Barbie and Ken family in a way.
Right. But they are from the roots of Barbie, exactly.
And you've written and studied about the history of Barbie and the influence Barbie has had on American culture. Can you talk about why it's important to look at the dolls that are being created, marketed, and sold to kids?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, one of the interesting things that is true about Barbie is its initial roots with its inventor, Ruth Handler. She sort of reinvented how kids can imagine their own play for themselves by bringing this three-dimensional doll to life. That's actually what inspired her, was seeing her own kids being frustrated, because at the time there were only baby dolls to mother or paper dolls that had those frustrating, annoying tabs that would grip. And so she sort of watched her daughter and her daughter's friends play and be frustrated and thought, wow, if I can three-dimensionalize play, then these kids can really just go to town imagining their own lives and their own career paths, and whatever they dream of, they can make happen. And so the doll was always sort of a conduit for that.
One of the criticisms of Barbie over the years was that it, at least according to some critics, still limited the scope of what someone could imagine, especially for a doll as a woman. Can you talk about that?
Sure. I mean, I think it's always important to remember something's history before criticizing it. So if we just sort of ground that in the fact that this doll was created in the late 50s in California, and that world was starlets and glamour, and sort of that was the ideal of the time in Hollywood in the 50s, and then go from there. But sort of adding to that, Ruth really saw that body shape as a mannequin. And that's where some of the dimensions came from. And so it did shift and change quite a lot over the years. And one of the things I think Mattel has historically been really good at is seeing what kind of societal changes are taking place and then reflecting that back in the changes that they have brought to the Barbie line since the 70s, really. Really actually starting with the fact that in the 50s, that very first doll had that very sort of sideways, almost coy, feminine glance. And then when the women's movement was in full swing in the 70s, they deliberately took that into account and looked around and thought, women are feeling differently now. And they gave Barbie that straight-on, direct gaze that she has today. And that was really in response to how people were feeling about femininity and about women's rights, et cetera. So I think that just continues along the timeline of the changes that they've made over the decades.
Talking to Tanya Lee Stone, her books include The Good, the Bad, and the Barbie. We're looking at a new line of gender-inclusive dolls released by Mattel. follow that thread now, because we have this new line, this creatable world. How do you see this matching with the latest conversation about gender we're having in the country?
Yeah, and I think this latest conversation, if we can call it that, is sort of based on, you know, the rumblings of the beginnings of that conversation that have been going on for years. And so now it starts to be in the collective consciousness. And young people are really resisting labels more and more now. So I feel like, why constrain them? I mean, I teach college, so I see this all the time. They resist labeling when it comes to everything in life, and that has to do with gender. And, you know, it's kind of knocked down barriers to play that have been ingrained for generations. If you give kids a doll or a toy that they can see themselves in, as opposed to have an image put upon them.
And so the way these dolls look, they have long and short hair wigs. They have a wide variety of clothes that could go stereotypically male and female. Talk about how that fits into what we know about how kids play.
Yeah, I think the kids like to experiment with all kinds of things. And I think, again, kids like to see themselves in their experiences, really in the same way that it's important for us to see ourselves in any creative output. It's important for us to see ourselves reflected in books, in films, in television shows, in magazines. And so, therefore, starting even with the youngest kids, it's important for them to be able to see themselves in the toy aisle, right? And instead of just having one or two choices, to be able to then take this doll and make up what feels comfortable to them and change things around and experiment. Walk in somebody else's shoes and, you know, just imagine a different way to be and kind of mix and match.
In their press release, Mattel says their research suggests that kids don't want their toys defined by gender norms. So this is, Mattel says at least, this is coming from what we know about kids. What do you think about that?
I think that's true, and I think that's always been true. You know, this extends to sort of the stereotype or stigma that boys shouldn't play with dolls. You know, we can go back to the 60s and 70s and you know, Charlotte Zolotow, a giant in the children's literature field, wrote a book called William's Doll, which was all about a little boy who wanted to play with a doll, and everybody made fun of him for it, and everybody told him that he shouldn't, including everyone in his family and his parents. And then the grandmother comes in at the end and says to her son, William's father, how can you expect him to grow up to be a loving father if you don't let him play with dolls and practice caregiving? And so I think that's part of all of these kind of divisions and labels that we try to put on people, that we're better off if we're just allowed to express ourselves and decide who we want to be.
We heard from Susan on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who says it's crucial that kids have access to dolls, action figures, books, movies, real role models, etc., that reflect all of them, not just the cultural norm. So Susan, agreeing with what you were saying there, has that been a trend, Tanya, in toys in general? Maybe slowly, but more and more reflection of a variety of people.
I think so. I'm not really an expert on those trends, but, you know, there do seem to be trends with large retailers in general starting to move away from quote-unquote boy and quote-unquote girl labels. I think Target has done away with those labels. I think Amazon even took away their categories that are searchable on Amazon for boy toys and girl toys. Although I do think that this marks the first time a toy company of this size has created a product with gender neutrality in mind.
Talking to Tanya Lee Stone, author of The Good, the Bad, and the Barbie. We're talking about a new line of inclusive dolls from Mattel, the toy company that also makes Barbie. And you can join in at 800-642-1234. Have you seen or heard about these dolls? What's your take? Do you have a child who would be into or not into playing and creating with them? And how did Barbie fit into your own life or the life of your kids growing up? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Right now, we're picking up our talk with author Tanya Lee Stone. Tanya teaches in the professional writing program at Champlain College in Vermont. She's the author of the book The Good, the Bad, and the Barbie. We're talking about the new Creatable World line of dolls from Mattel, makers of Barbie. They say the new dolls don't conform to gender norms and says that's what they learned kids today were looking for. You can join in at 800-642-1234. If you ever talked with your kid about gender and gender roles in the context of the dolls or toys they play with, do you like this idea of dolls that have long and short hair options, a variety of clothing options that are more stereotypically masculine or feminine? You can mix or match along the way. Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Tanya, I want to come back to Barbie in 2019. We have this new line of Creatable World dolls, but Barbie is still with us. You talked about how she changed with the times up to the 70s. How do you see her fitting in today?
How do I see her fitting in today? Well, I think that the brand itself continues to change and adapt. And I think that that has to do with small things like accessories and bigger things like packaging of careers that Barbie might have that have changed over the years. And it also has to do with coming out with more and more dolls that have different skin tones and just being generally more representative of the world at large and kind of expanding that worldview than if you look back, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20, all sort of all along the way, they've sort of continued to make tweaks and changes to the Barbie lines.
We heard from Jocelyn on the Ideas Network Facebook page, who writes, every little girl who ever had a Barbie, it's all about the long hair, brushing it and fixing it over and over and over. Jocelyn worried that the new dolls with the short hair might give them to kids, but doesn't think that would be the one they play with. What do you think, Tanya?
Oh, I think that's interesting. One of the things that I did in the book was sort of look to people to send in their anecdotes about Barbie. I collected about 500 anecdotes about Barbie and how people played with her and role-playing and diversity and all of these different things, body image. And hair came up quite often, but not always as you think, not always as this listener is describing. There were lots of kids who chopped the hair off of the Barbies, wanted bald Barbies, and you know, really wanted to change them, would color the hair, and were very frustrated with the fact that the hair was, you know, long blonde hair, and wanted to make those changes to it. So I kind of found that fascinating, that hair really was a focus, but the focus changed all over the place in many different ways.
And in the new line, the Creatable World dolls, it sounds like there will be a short and long hair option. So I guess if you want a short hair version, you don't have to chop it all off yourself irrevocably.
Exactly. Yeah, you can kind of swap it out and try on different styles.
And you said earlier that the original intent of Barbie was to give more flexibility to kids. Do you see the new line of dolls just maybe following that trend, adding more flexibility now in today's day and age?
I do, absolutely. I think if Ruth Handler was alive today, she would be very happy about this. I think that this is completely in line with her intentions. And I think she's probably smiling somewhere right now.
We heard from Linda on the Ideas Network Facebook page. For folks that find them, the new dolls, confusing, Linda writes, you don't find dolls with large breasts and makeup and feet bent for high heels disturbing. That's a bit of criticism that's been leveled at a variety of dolls over the years, Tanya.
Sure, absolutely. I like the fact that these Creatable World dolls are actually, they've gone a little bit younger with them, and they've made them very kind of neutral, no makeup, very just sort of, you know, fresh face. They don't have a lot of blingy accessories. I hate to use this word, but they're kind of wholesome.
Why do you hate to use the word, though?
I don't know. It has so many different connotations
true. Okay.
to it, but it was the word that sprang to mind.
Sure. Talking to Tanya Lee Stone about this new line of dolls from Mattel, the makers of Barbie, the Creatable World dolls. Many people calling them gender neutral or gender inclusive. Still time for you to call in if you'd like. Hearing a lot on the Ideas Network Facebook page. You can call with your thoughts at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. One of our commenters on the Ideas Network Facebook page says, I feel this discussion of gender-neutral dolls is stupid. I feel this issue is more for the parent than the kid. Kids will play with whatever. If they want this doll, okay. If they want that doll, okay. Stop making adult insecurities a problem for kids. So the case here is that this is an argument in the grown-up world, and we're translating into doll term for kids. What do you think, Tanya?
Interesting. I would have to respectfully disagree with that because I think a lot of the conversations that are being had were generated from kids who are struggling with their identities and who, you know, they talk to their parents or their caregivers, and then those conversations get generated. I think you can find probably as many instances of that as you can of adult-driven conversations. So, and certainly in the adolescent world, that's true. You know, middle school and high school kids are grappling with issues and they're talking about issues in much more open ways, I think, historically than ever. I think our culture has become much more tolerant of open conversations. And therefore, I think a lot of kids are comfortable talking about things today that they might not have been a couple of generations ago.
Well, Tanya, I'm going to shift gears a little bit because, as it happens, you're going to be in Wisconsin pretty soon, October 16th at UW-Eau Claire from 7 to 8 p.m. To talk about your new book, A Girl Rising, about educational opportunities for girls around the world. Can you give us a sneak preview of some of what you're going to be talking about?
Sure, absolutely. Yes, that book, Girl Rising, Changing the World One Girl at a Time, is really a book that seeks to answer the question, why are there 130 million girls globally who are not being educated? And those are big reasons. Those are reasons like poverty and gender discrimination and child marriage and modern-day slavery and limited or no access to education. And so this book was inspired by a documentary called Girl Rising of the same name. I went and saw that film with my own teenagers when it came out in 2013, and the whole time I was watching it, that film beautifully focused on all of these issues through the lens of nine stories of nine girls, one from each of nine countries that represented these different obstacles to education. And the whole time I sat there in the movie theater, I thought, this is so unbelievably important. I want to work on this and add to this canon and see if I can break down these obstacles for younger readers and add more girls to the stories and really unpack these obstacles to education, and also kind of give people some tools as to how they might be able to help. Because when there are overwhelming problems like this, it's sometimes really easy for us to think about, oh, this happens to other people in other places. But really, the single most powerful tool that we have to creating a more functional and healthy world in general is the education of girls. It's a statistically proven international fact. So I worked in conjunction with the Girl Rising Foundation to be able to write this book, and I basically am telling it in three sections. The first is the stakes, which sort of breaks down what these obstacles are and where are they happening and why. And the big bulk of the book, I'd say two-thirds of the book, are as many stories about girls who represented getting out of difficult situations and into school and how that was changing their path, to share as many of those stories of hopefulness as we could. And then the third section is called The Solutions, and that's really geared toward helping people understand how they can get involved and help with some of these obstacles around the world, because it affects all of us.
Right. As you say, for somebody maybe here in the United States, this might seem to be problems in a faraway place that we can't make a difference on. What kind of things in your solutions section do you recommend that people here could do to help help with the Girls Rising?
Well, there are all kinds of things that people can do. And generally, they come down to raising money, because it's hard to affect change in other places without fundraising dollars. But to make that sort of accessible to, you know, an average middle school or high school student or just an adult who wants to get involved, I sort of encourage people to think about what they love or are passionate about in their own lives, and then taking that love and turning it into something that's a fundraiser that can directly help some girls. For example, if you love to bike ride, if you're a cyclist, you could do a fundraiser, a little bike marathon, or hold any kind of fundraiser that you wanted for cycling, and you could donate that money to an organization, like a non-governmental organization like Pink Bike in Cambodia, that delivers bicycles to children who need transportation to get from their villages to their schools.
And talk a little more about the stakes. What do we as a species, I guess, as a planet lose if this, if literally millions of girls don't have access to any kind of education?
Well, I mean, it's this whole notion that this is an interconnected global society that we're living in. So just because we have clean water and free school in the United States doesn't mean that we should take for granted and not understand that there are people in more than 50 countries around the world that that's not true for. And if we're not a healthy global society, the more and more interconnected we become, the worse that is for everyone. It's always been terrible to sort of discover the injustices that happen in other parts of the world from where you might be. But it's harder and harder to sort of ignore that we're not all part of the same planet.
Tanya, we'll leave it there. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate it.
That's Tanya Lee Stone, an author and teacher at Champlain College, author of the book The Good, The Bad, and The Barbie. We talked to her today about a new line of gender nonconforming dolls from Mattel. Plus, we got a sneak preview of her appearance next month at UW Eau Claire. Tanya's speaking on October 16th from 7 to 8 p.m. about her newer book, Girl Rising. She looked into the lack of educational opportunities for girls around the world. Coming up after the news, federal regulators are taking a closer look at a popular acid reflux drug after tests showed samples had low levels of a carcinogen. We'll talk to a reporter who covers the drug industry about the details and what to do if you're taking it. And by the way, thanks to everyone who contributed during our fall member drive. You donated more than $525,000. 2,975 listeners joined in. We're glad to welcome more than 625 new members to the WPR family. Thank you so much for your support over the week plus of the member drive. Back to normal now. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, often overshadowed by the opioid crisis, the biggest drug problem in some communities across the United States remains methamphetamines, and it's a particularly big issue in western Wisconsin. A county sheriff gives us a firsthand look at the problem. First, the largest pharmacy chain in the country is pulling a popular heartburn medication from its shelves after federal regulators found low levels of a cancer-causing chemical in drug samples. The generic drug is called ranitidine, but it's commonly known as Zantac, a popular brand name version. The Federal Food and Drug Administration confirmed low levels of a carcinogen in the drug more than 2 weeks ago, but has declined so far to issue a mandatory recall. The move by CVS this weekend comes as other governments have gone further than the FDA and as other pharmacies and drug manufacturers have started halting distribution on their own. Katie Thomas covers the business of healthcare and the drug industry at the New York Times. Katie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks for having me.
Can you tell us, Katie, more about what the FDA is seeing in these samples of this pretty widely used reflux drug?
Yes, the FDA said earlier this month that it had found that some samples, well, actually the samples of some versions of ranitidine contained NDMA, which, as you said, is considered a probable human carcinogen. They have stopped short of asking companies to recall it, and they've said that people who are taking the drug can continue to take it. At the same time, they've also said that if you're taking the drug over the counter, you know, it might not be a bad idea to switch to something else, since there are a lot of different heartburn drugs that you can take.
And let's talk about the low levels and what exactly that means. Clearly, if they're not recalling, it means it's not something that's going to be an instant health hazard. It's not going to harm you today. What are the concerns over long-term use?
Right. You're right. They haven't recalled it, and they haven't said exactly what they mean by those low levels, although they did say that in the release that they put out that it was an amount that barely exceed amounts that you might expect to find in common foods. Because the thing is that NDMA is found in a lot of different stuff. It's sometimes found in water. It's found in grilled meats, some dairy products. And so the question is kind of what level you're being exposed to over time. That's a concern. And obviously, ranitidine or Zantac is a very widely used drug. It's over the counter. It's given to infants. It's seen as extremely safe. And so, you know, it's something that is a concern just because so many people take it.
Now, the FDA, as you say, hasn't recalled the drug. Other countries, some are handling this differently. How have we seen other nations' health departments react to this?
Yeah, the biggest different one is Canada, which is obviously right to our north. And Canada has asked companies to stop distribution of the drug. They, too, have stopped short of ordering a full recall, although some companies, both in the U.S. and Canada, have decided to recall their products. But the U.S. The U.S. FDA is not asking for a halt in distribution while Canada has. And other countries have also followed suit in asking for a halt to distribution.
That's an official request for recalls. But when we see a pharmacy chain the size of CVS taking this off their shelves, that's a pretty big part of the industry, right?
Right, and Walgreens as well too. And notable is that they've taken all all ranitidine products, you know, the generic and the branded off of their shelves.
Talking to Katie Thomas from the New York Times, looking at ranitidine, aka Zantac. That's the commercial version, a popular acid reflux medication. Concerns over a potentially cancer-causing material being found in samples of it, and different chains, different distributors taking different approaches to it. Katie, is there a talk that there could still be a recall? Is this something the FDA seems to be weighing, or no?
I think what we're going to have to see, it's definitely a developing story. The FDA, just to be clear, I might not have been clear enough. The FDA doesn't usually order a recall. That's a really unusual step. Usually the companies decide to take that step on their own. And one key question that seems to be so far unanswered is where this NDMA is coming from. Listeners may remember that there was NDMA that was found in a similarly very widely used drug, Valsartan, for high blood pressure. And that was found to be a contaminant from the manufacturing process. And it was these widespread recalls that occurred last year. And so it's not clear if this is also something similar, or as an independent pharmacy recently found, they have a different idea, which is that it could be that the ranitidine essentially degrades or reacts with itself to create NDMA when the drug is processed, which would obviously indicate that it's a much wider issue because it's basically inherent to the drug itself versus something that could have been contaminated in certain lots of certain drugs.
Do we know what kinds of cancer NDMA could be associated with?
I have to say I'm not 100% sure. That one thing that I do know is that it's been linked to cancer in lab tests, but it has not been definitively tied to causing cancer in humans, as I understand it.
You looked, and you've touched on this a little already, you looked at the message that's going out to consumers who are probably justifiably a little concerned. A lot of people take ranitidine, including me. So people are looking at, okay, I take this stuff. What do I do? Can you talk about the different guidance, the different bits of advice that we're hearing for people in that situation?
Yeah, I mean, I can see that it's very concerning. You know, not only is it widely used, but people give it to their babies. You know, the FDA, you know, as I said, has been pretty, you know, even keeled, I would say, and not trying to raise the alarms here. They've said that people can continue to keep taking it, especially if you have a prescription form of the drug. They've urged you to contact your doctor and talk to your doctor about perhaps switching to something else or not. But they have advised you not to just simply stop taking a prescription drug. If it's over the counter, that's a little bit different. It's obviously something that the consumer has opted on their own to buy. And in that case, they actually are suggesting that you perhaps try something else, try a different drug that's over the counter.
Now, on the bigger picture of how the FDA ensures drug quality, one complicating factor is that a drug might be made in the United States. The active ingredient might be sourced to other countries. Can you talk about just the complicated nature of keeping tabs on what's in the tablets?
Yeah, it's very complex, and that really came out in the other case I was talking about, the Valsartan case. I mean, the truth is that most of the active pharmaceutical ingredients that are in our drugs are manufactured overseas in places like China and India. The U.S. FDA does inspect those facilities, but there's a lot of gaps in their inspection, and there's a lot of room for problems with quality.
And then, as you mentioned, there's the Zantac brand name, and then there's generic ranitidine made by different companies. Is the part of the next step to try to figure out if all versions of ranitidine have this potential carcinogen in them?
Right, and that's the inherent, you know, question right now is if it's a particular brand or it's all brands. The FDA did tell me when their release first went out, they told me that every single one of the samples tested positive for low levels of NDMA. So that could suggest that it's a problem with the drug itself and not necessarily the manufacturing process. Similarly, CVS, you know, took all forms of ranitidine off the market. And same when you look at Health Canada's action. While they said they were investigating it, they recommended that companies halt their distribution of all forms of it. So that would seem to point to a more widespread question about the drug itself. But we still don't know.
As you mentioned earlier, Katie, this is a developing story. What are the next developments you're watching for?
I'm really curious to see what the FDA says next. They haven't put out any real new results from their further investigation. So I'll be looking for that. Also, Sanofi, which makes the brand name, has stood by its product. It has not joined those who have decided to recall or have stopped distribution, and has pointed to the statements of the FDA that it's very low levels that have been found. So I'll be curious to see what happens with the brand name version as well.
Katie, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Katie Thomas, healthcare and drug industry reporter at the New York Times. She was with us today to talk about what we know about the health risks of a potentially cancer-causing chemical that was found in low levels in the heartburn medication Zantac, generic name ranitidine, and what to do if you or someone you know is on the medication and has questions. Coming up, methamphetamine use continues to be a big problem in western Wisconsin and elsewhere. We'll ask the Polk County Sheriff why that is and what's being done about it. Stay with us here on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, can you believe what you see in online videos? Deepfake videos are getting more sophisticated, and that has some experts worried about how they could affect the next election. We'll find out more about deepfakes, what they are, and what's being done to stop them. First, heroin, synthetic opioids like fentanyl, and painkillers have been getting a lot of attention in recent years. What hasn't gotten as much focus is methamphetamine use. A former division head at the Drug Enforcement Administration recently told Yahoo Finance that meth is still the largest problem across the country. He said, quote, "It's really, really out of control." Here in Wisconsin, meth was involved in about 6% of cases at the state crime labs in 2010. Last year, it more than tripled to 20% of that number. That's more than heroin and fentanyl combined. And it's especially a big problem in western Wisconsin. Brent Walk is the Polk County Sheriff. Sheriff Walk, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
Well, you're on the front lines there. Can you tell us what you're seeing in your communities?
Well, it's a day-to-day battle to combat the methamphetamine problem in northwest Wisconsin. And, you know, we're doing a lot of things. As you know, we've always been a higher number county for stats on meth. And a lot of that is largely because we try to always attack the problem. And, you know, with that, you generate a lot of numbers, and that kind of sometimes has a shock value. But we're also doing some innovative things to treat the back end of the problem, and I'd like to get into some of that maybe with you as well.
Let's go right there. What are you trying to do to deal with maybe the roots of this problem?
Well, we know it's generational. We see it now. I've got 24 years in law enforcement, so I'm starting to see a second generation of the same family deal with meth in our county. One of the things, we had a county board resolution on a meth initiative a year ago, and with that they funded taking over the county's CJCC program. It's Criminal Justice Collaborating Council, and that gets all the stakeholders involved at a sit-down once a month, and we try to come up with ways to treat the meth problem on the backside through, like, treatment court, through jail programs, and, you know, not just looking to go out and arrest, but actually to find a way to combat this problem so we don't see the constant recidivism in the people returning to jail over and over and over for the meth problems.
So you said it's a generational problem. So a kid grows up in a family where addiction to meth or other drugs is a problem, and they're likely, more likely maybe, to end up in that same situation?
Absolutely. And we're embracing the DEC, the Drug Endangered Children programs in our county here, which is something that, you know, years ago when we served a drug search warrant, our goal was to get that contraband. And oftentimes, you know, there'd be kids in these houses, and you wouldn't arrest the mother, so she was there to watch the kids. And now we do immediately work with our child protection resources, and we remove the children right on site from the search warrant if we find methamphetamine and it is accessible to the children and things like that. So we really take that approach. When we find some meth, we'll measure how high it is off the ground, and could a toddler reach that? We really try to document where we find it and even look at that angle of it.
You mentioned addiction treatment resources. Are there enough resources to meet the needs of the people in your community and other counties in western Wisconsin?
There are not. And that is the largest hurdle in all of this. Is one is cost. And treatment, as you know, is very expensive. And ultimately, treatment is the key to some of these addiction problems. And, you know, we have a drug court program that is very successful. But part of the prerequisite to get in drug court is you cannot be a violent offender. And unfortunately, meth creates violence. And in some of our more violent calls and violent circumstances surround the use of methamphetamine. So that's another hurdle, is to find somebody we can get in treatment court that doesn't have the violence associated with it.
I've seen other law enforcement officials in your part of the state say a lot of the crime that happens in our community, even if it's not directly a drug crime, it's related to meth. Is that something you're seeing too?
It is, and we're in a part of the state where we have a lot of property crime. We have burglaries, we have thefts, and it's largely affiliated with that drug game, that they're fueling their habit by stealing things, and it really is it's a web of dysfunction.
Talking to Brent Walk, the sheriff of Polk County, about methamphetamine. It is a big problem, though it doesn't get quite as much attention as opioids of various sorts, heroin and fentanyl and the like. And Sheriff Walk, why do you think that is? Why do you think that the opioids are so much on our radar, a real problem for sure, but so much more so than meth is?
Well, ultimately, with the opioids and the heroin, you end up having a lot of overdose deaths, and that shocks a community. Meth is very nuisance related. We have a lot of theft. We have a lot of property crimes. We also have some, you know, domestic crime, violent type crimes. You know, you get a lot of disorderly situations pertaining to meth. But I don't think it shocks the public as much as the heroin and the opioid crisis has. So I think it's largely been that has overshadowed the meth problem. But, you know, meth is the big issue in northwest Wisconsin. The opioid issue has not had a large impact. We see a little bit of it, but we don't see a lot. Nothing like what we see in southern Wisconsin.
Now, I know you're not a doctor, but while meth doesn't have that instant fatal overdose problem that we associate with heroin, I'm sure you see long-term health problems for those who you see using meth.
Yes, and, you know, as the sheriff here, I frequently am sending out mug photos, and there are times we'll send out a mug photo and we'll have a list of what the person looked like 10 years ago when they were arrested for a minor crime, and now, you know, after using meth, I mean, these people, it ages them so much, they look so rough, it really does take a toll on a person, and I'm sure everybody has seen those before and after pictures, and it is the harsh reality of using meth.
Let's talk a little bit about production and distribution. It wasn't that long ago in parts of Wisconsin, parts of Michigan, I know you'd see at rest stops and truck stops signs of what to watch out for in the woods, watching for meth labs, things like that. It seems like that's not necessarily how meth is getting out there as much anymore.
Right. And, you know, it's interesting. I'll give the legislators a lot of credit for this. They regulated Sudafed, and that's what essentially, you know, curtailed all the labs because the key essential ingredient, pseudoephedrine, was no longer accessible. You had to go to a pharmacy to get it and sign your name in a book. It wasn't sold at every gas station. And I give the legislators a lot of credit for that because they took some initiative and it worked. So ultimately, our meth comes from the Twin Cities. We're geographically located about, you know, we're a border county, and the Twin Cities is just across the border. So that's where our meth comes from, and that is largely, you know, we can talk border security in this country, but ultimately the meth is coming in from the southern border of the United States.
Are there things other things you could see at the state or federal level that would help you on either end of this problem, the supply side of things, the treatment side of things, anywhere across the board?
Well, you know, this is a complex problem, and there's not one easy solution. And we try to get our community involved, and we get everybody involved at the table to discuss this. But ultimately, treatment is expensive. You know, we need treatment alternatives, and they need funding for that. You know, it's not one quick fix. Obviously, tighter border security and the regulation of illegal drugs coming across our border is a big part of that. But the fact is, you know, America has an appetite for this, and it's supply-demand. So if you can cut the supply, you know, certainly that's going to help reduce our cases. But, you know, meth, it's an addiction problem. And ultimately, you know, we got to find a way to break that chain of dysfunction.
When we talk about opioid addiction, it really seems to cut across demographics, age, race, urban-rural, like everybody seems to be at risk. Do you see something similar with meth, or is it targeting one particular demographic?
Well, that's what's so interesting about meth is I have watched people that were successful businessmen, middle-aged. I've seen successful people that were in farming. There hasn't been any unique class of people, and once they try meth, it's like their life is completely out of control and spiraling out of control within 6 months. And it isn't just young kids. This is people of all ages that try it. And it is so detrimental once they start using.
Time for a quick call. Adam is with us in La Crosse. Adam, hi.
Hi. I'm just sitting with a group listening to this conversation. And as we were listening to it, we heard the whole county officer speak about how they're taking care of things on the back end of the situation. So me and a few others, we're kind of shocked as to why you would take care of the back end more so than focus on the front end, as in preventing the problem, which, you know, as we listen to the conversation further, would also lessen the cost of treatment programs and all those other ancillary costs.
Adam, thanks for the call. So you're talking about treatment, Brent. What is out there when it comes to prevention, trying to help make sure people don't start to begin with?
Well, with Adam's question there, I think that's a great question, and I think the answer for that is we've always attacked the front end of this, and we always will. But we're learning we cannot arrest our way out of this problem. We need to have a system in place to deal with all these addicts. And yes, we go out and we aggressively arrest. We've added another canine position in the last year, which is a very effective tool on detecting and locating narcotics while we're working. But ultimately, we've always attacked the front, and we always will. But we've now started to look at how can we make it so we're not arresting the same people over and over and over. We got to find a way to get something on the backside.
Adam, thanks for the call. And Sheriff Walker, in our last few moments as we wrap up, do you have a message for people in communities affected by meth? How can everyday people help turn this around?
Well, I think they can turn it around by, you know, paying close attention to their communities. And when they see what they believe is a drug house, to tip their law enforcement off and to be vigilant. I love community meetings when communities get together and try to come up with solutions for this. And that's ultimately what it's going to take to solve this problem.
Sheriff Walk, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you.
That's Brent Walk, Polk County Sheriff. We talked with him about the growing use of methamphetamines in Wisconsin, especially western and northwestern Wisconsin. About 20% of drug cases at the state crime labs involved meth, up from around 6% in 2010. Authorities say a lot of the meth today is coming from Mexico and the West Coast. Is this a problem you're seeing in your community? You can share your story, what you're seeing. You can tweet us at Central Time WPR, or you can always email ideas@WPR.org. Let us know how this problem is affecting you, your neighborhood, and your town. Last week, we heard about a project from the Wisconsin Historical Society where they're taking old state newspapers and turning them into online digital documents that you can read and search. Following up on that, this weekend, the Wisconsin State Journal shared an article from September of 1844 from their archives in what was then called the Madison Express. The article tells the story of all the bears that kept showing up in the Madison area, 15 or 20 bears in a two-week span, including a few sighted within a half mile of the Capitol. That was interesting, but then I thought, the Capitol? This is 1844. Wisconsin's not going to be a state for another 4 years. After some online digging, yes, indeed, Madison became the capital of the Wisconsin Territory in 1838. The first capital in 1836 was Belmont in Lafayette County, but here's where it gets weird. In 1837, the capital of the Wisconsin Territory was Burlington, but not Burlington, Wisconsin, Burlington, Iowa. What? For a stretch of time, the Wisconsin Territory included Wisconsin, Minnesota, Iowa, and part of the Dakotas. The boundaries changed a lot. It gets really confusing. But in 1837, Iowa was apparently still part of Wisconsin Territory, and that's where our capital was. In 1838, Iowa split off, and the capital was moved to Madison. The rest was bear-infested history. It's good that they made the move. The drive from Burlington, Iowa, to the Dubuque, Wisconsin Bridge is just shy of 150 miles, a long drive for our state capital team. This is Central Time on the Ideas Network.